Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When investment performance matters, make sure your savings are with Zurich. Visit zurich.ie to find out more.
It's now or never. That's one line from this afternoon's damning climate change report, which we reported on a little earlier. We're going to hear now from one of the report's chief authors. Michael Grubb is Professor of International Energy and Climate Change Policy at the University College London. And he joins us now. And Michael, good evening to the programme. And you're welcome to the programme, rather. It's a 3,000-page report. What are the big messages that people need to know?
Well, I think your news item there covered it pretty well. I could even say your weather report, in a sense, of mixed outlook, a lot of grey, but also some sunny patches. You could say that describes the finding of the report. There is a lot of grey. The emissions have continued to increase globally. We are clearly heading in the wrong direction. But the report also stresses that to tackle climate change with the level of ambition set out in the Paris Agreement, which all countries have signed, we need for the 1.5 goal to get a global emissions basically peaking within the next 3 years and falling by over 40% by 2030. For the 2-degree end of that range, because that's what the Paris Agreement says, it gives you the 1.5, 2-degree range, then we've still got to get global emissions down by over a quarter by 2030. Turning the ship of fossil fuel around on that timescale is not a trivial task, but the report says there are clear areas of progress in both technologies, countries that are successfully getting their emissions down, but there has to be huge acceleration of those efforts.
So when you say huge acceleration, I mean, what would it mean? Because one of the findings from the report was that average annual greenhouse gas emissions during 2010 to 2019, so in the last decade, were higher than any previous decade, which is bad news, obviously, especially since we all knew very well what the problem was. But at the same time, it says the rate of growth in that time period was lower than the previous decade, which is a little bit of good news. What needs to be done in order to make sure that greenhouse gas emissions peak within the next 4 years?
So, This problem is one of the things that makes it tricky is there are several different sectors involved and we've made more progress in some than others. So energy emissions like electricity supply and so forth used to be growing at about 3% a year. That's down to 1% a year. Industrial emissions, similarly. Transport emissions have kept powering up, global average we're talking about. So there are, let me stress that the report does also emphasize there's around 20 or more countries that have sustained emission reductions for over a decade, and some of them actually at quite substantial rates. But those tend to be, you know, a limited number of countries compared with almost 200 countries globally, and focus more on energy sector, the electricity progress than some other areas. It's why
Before you move on from that, because I saw that in the report that there's at least 18 countries that have sustained greenhouse gas emission reductions for longer than 10 years. So it can be done. Countries are doing it. Can you just give us some detail on, you know, one or two of those countries that are doing really well? And what is it that they're doing that the rest of us don't seem to be able to do?
Well, I mean, I can speak to sort of example right close to home here in the UK. Where we've seen dramatic reductions in the electricity sector emissions. And that was a combination of some measures on improving electricity efficiency, tougher, for example, standards on appliances. The UK, after, you know, the old saying, got it right after lots of attempts have got it wrong, but on renewable energy, policies introduced in 2014 have dramatically accelerated progress in renewable energy. Including at scale offshore wind. We also had a sizable carbon price with a floor price so the industry knew it would get more expensive to burn fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And so there was substantial fuel switching. Result, we've halved emissions in the power sector. So that's one example. But there are, you know, there's other examples around the world. Some are much better than the UK at buildings energy efficiency, for example. Norway has stormed ahead with electric vehicles. So, you know, those examples, basically, you could say the report says, look, given what we know about the problem, given that we have these examples of progress, given that the cost of these technologies have come down, there is no excuse now for not delivering the kind of changes that we need.
Okay, so what then happens if we don't reach this target of stopping the increase in global greenhouse gas emissions by 2025? If we don't do that in the coming years, what temperature increase can we expect to see?
Well, what will really happen is, let's say we fall way short of those targets I talked about for 2030. A lot of the analysis of the report looks at those kind of pathways. Is we will have built significant degrees of fossil fuel infrastructure that simply cannot sensibly be used without destabilizing the climate in really dangerous ways. So people will have wasted a lot of money and given themselves a devastating choice between losing their investments or messing up the planet in very, very serious ways. So which of those paths people take, I can't predict. But it's a pretty stupid thing to do in terms of basically building things that you know are incompatible with clear commitments you've taken under the Paris Agreement on the base of overwhelming scientific evidence.
And yet we have seen the evidence that, you know, despite the science on this, that governments continue to do the wrong thing, really, when it comes to climate change, haven't we? So how do we turn that around?
So how we turn that around, I think, I mean, lots of things. Like I say, there's no single magic bullet in this. But on the other hand, in the report, there's a fascinating chart. A couple of charts, just how much the cost of renewables have come down over the past decade. In many areas of the world, renewable energy is actually now cheaper than the fossil fuel trajectory would be. And that is a really striking turnaround. Electric vehicles are heading the same way. So, but all these things can face obstacles, right? The existing industries don't really want to change. People may feel uncomfortable with electric vehicles if governments don't sort out their act on charging points. Clearly, licensing new fossil fuels is sending exactly the wrong signal to the industry. There are things that individuals can do as well, some just in the old advice about using energy efficiency, stop wasting energy. We all know some of the things that can be done. But also a strong message of the report is the scope for individuals to do stuff just on their own is limited. They're probably the biggest areas would be choice in diets, for example. But other things, a lot can be done if government facilitate it. Government design cities better to make cycling safer, if governments install what's needed for electric vehicle use to be a comfortable, normal, default, and cheaper way of getting around, then individuals can do a lot. And the same in the building sector. It's very hard for your average tenant to do anything about a leaky building. Governments have to get stuck in and make sure that landlords and homeowners have to meet the highest standards and facilitate insulating buildings. It's shocking how much we waste.
You made the point earlier that there has been reductions in carbon emissions in some sectors, and other sectors then we've seen a rise, and you mentioned transport as being one of those sectors where we've seen a rise. We've also seen a rise as well, haven't we, in agriculture. What about that aspect of it and what we're doing there or not doing there? What needs to be done in that sector to try and tackle what's going on?
So, well, you mentioned two sectors, just to flag what the report, drilling down in transport, it does say there's a certain amount that can be done by behaviour, city design, etc. For most, obviously, people want to move around, totally. Electric vehicles for most land transport now look like a very attractive option if government facilitates the charging infrastructure. Longer distance, we have more limited options. There is some scope for biofuels. You may have to be looking at aspects of carbon removal. For agriculture, as you asked, it's trite but true, but beef is incredibly greenhouse gas intensive, and eating too much red meat is not good for health. Choosing cleaner and more healthy diets is quite a significant thing that can be done. There are technical fixes for some elements of agriculture as well. Quite a lot of it is in a fairly early stage, but one can, you know, involve hormones that reduce the methane emissions from cows, for example. We do see a lot of excitement around lab-grown meats. So, you know, I just think we're a little bit late on the scene with ideas in agriculture, but they are coming forward.
But it is important, isn't it? I mean, Nuala, for example, has texted the programme saying, I'm hearing nothing about animal agriculture's contribution to the climate crisis in today's coverage of that climate report. Well, we are discussing it now, Nuala, but thank you for making the point. She says, I live in rural Ireland. I have no choice but to drive a car, but I do have a choice when it comes to the food that I put in my mouth. The meat-based diet has to go, simple as that, she says. Well, I think for a lot of people, probably it's not quite as simple as that, but it is important. And I wonder, Michael, do you think there's enough emphasis on the importance of everyone's diet and what difference that could make?
Well, the report does look at that quite extensively. How much that gets picked up in terms of headline messages and what people want to talk about, obviously it does touch on potentially sensitive areas of people's choice to live and eat as they wish. But I think there is an issue about social recognition of what are healthy choices and socially responsible choices. And I think the fact that those two go together is actually often, obviously some parts of the world people are malnutritioned and absolutely they need, you know, wherever they can get their protein, but in most of the West our problem is not having not enough meat, it is having far too much and all that flows from that. So there is a lot that we can do in the diet area, I think, of Western countries. It may be that, you know, many governments are just a bit more wary of raising that because it does feel like an intrusion on personal choice. People need to stand up and say, are they willing to do their bit for the planet? Because governments can do quite a bit for everything.
There's big lobby groups as well, though, that would be campaigning against any move to a more vegetarian diet or vegan diet.
Well, I mean, if you step back from that comment, I think one of the things we've learned on climate change, as you said, we knew how serious this problem was a decade ago and more. Why have we not done so as much as we should? And one of the things the report does say is, well, maybe, you know, there's been too much analysis at, you know, the global technical technology economics area and not enough in terms of A, really engaging people, this is social choice, but also recognizing that whatever global analysis you do, we live in a world of almost 200 different countries. One of the things in the IPCC process, clearly, which governments are engaged in negotiating line by line, the policymaker summary, is they're standing up and saying, well, these global averages, you know, our country has special circumstances, we have these concerns, these interests, and really wanting a lot of persuasion about, you know, is this robust? This is an awkward conclusion for us. We really want to test the waters.
Yeah, well, actually on that and on awkward conclusions, in the next month or so, Ireland's carbon tax that we have in place at the moment is due to be increased slightly. And there's a debate as to whether or not that increase should go ahead, given the rising cost of fuel and the cost of living for people. We'll be talking about it later in the programme today, actually. But I'm interested in your thoughts on that, Michael. For example, carbon tax. And how important that is with behaviour and, you know, what sort of choices governments are faced with, like, for example, the Irish government in relation to raising carbon taxes when there are other pressures on people.
So I wouldn't want to comment directly on the Irish situation. I would, though, underline, first of all, a general message in the report is that whilst often economists would say the most important thing is to get prices right, and if these emissions are damaging, they should be priced and people should pay for it. Actually, the report also says one thing we've learned over the last decade or more is it's really mixes of policies that have really delivered. So, you know, the countries that have sustained reductions and the big emission reductions and the big reductions in technology costs have come where governments have directly pushed renewables. They've supported those technologies going into markets at scale. And that can occur alongside carbon prices, which gives people, if the markets are structured in the right way, the choice to move away from carbon intensive things, avoid those carbon costs, and tap into cheaper energy. Now, that gets to be a complicated thing. But the message is multiple policies, and they do need to be sensitive to personal circumstances. So if this is a time of unprecedented energy prices, if people feel they want to pause the increase, that's entirely understandable. They need to understand, you know, energy prices in the long run, cost of carbon is only going one way. It's getting scarcer and more expensive. We need to change.
I might just ask you then finally about, you mentioned the importance for governments to make sure that buildings are carbon efficient for people, and that landlords make sure that the leaky roof is fixed, etc. And we have a question from one of our listeners about the sort of grants for home energy upgrades that are available in the UK and how do they compare to Ireland. Now, I don't expect, Michael, that you know what we have here, but recently enough, the government has announced a new retrofitting scheme, and there's, for example, a special enhanced grant. It's equivalent to 80% of the typical cost for attic and cavity wall insulation for all households, and then also grants of up to 50% for a typical deep retrofit. And some of our listeners are wondering, how does that compare to what's available elsewhere?
Sounds like that's definitely moving in the right direction. One thing, though, we see is the countries that have made a lot of progress in efficient buildings, and it is remarkable when you look at Scandinavia, much colder winters, their buildings are so much more efficient than we have, at least in the UK and I suspect in Ireland. One of the big things they do is actually just have tough building standards. They just say you can't build a building unless it's like this. Where we've already got a lot of leaky buildings, old and leaky buildings, that is more complicated. But I think, you know, we are in combined crises now. We're in a combination of a major energy crisis and a major climate crisis. And if governments actually take that word seriously, we should be looking at things like saying you can't sell a home unless it has met a certain energy efficiency standard. And provide a grant to support that. But that's a great time to intervene, particularly if people have left the building. It's there. It's easier and cheaper for building engineers to come in and make them much more efficient. And governments just need to start laying down the law on that kind of thing.
All right. Michael Grubb, Professor of International Energy and Climate Change Policy at the University College London. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. We'll take a break.